In terms of history and in terms of contributing to the growth of our society and our country, LB Sachs has played such a huge role in terms of being a constitutional court judge, but then also in terms of being an activist and focusing on human rights across the globe. He's really one of our best ambassadors. What fascinates me too is how he incorporates art and how he's really, really helped artists to bring their messages to the fore. So to sit down with him and discuss his exhibition, which is currently on at the Zeiss MoCA, Spring is Rebellious, was a true honor. LB, what a pleasure and a privilege to sit with you here in your home and have a chance to chat to you about so many different things. I mean, I've got so many questions. I finally saw Spring is Rebellious yesterday at the Zeiss MoCA, and to see how your story, the story of our country, art, how you see art as such an integral part of who we are as a nation, I really enjoyed how that was all put together. How would you say that art has impacted who LB Sachs is?
Yeah, people often say, LB, you're very interested in culture. Mm. Why did you bring culture into politics, which seems to be a totally different realm? In fact, it was culture got me into politics. Mm. I grew up in a very political home. My dad, Solly Sachs, General Secretary of the Garment Workers Union of South Africa, separated from my mom. And my mom had been the typist for Moses Kotane, General Secretary of the Communist Party of South Africa. And she'd say, tidy up, Uncle Moses is coming to little picky me and my little picky brother. And we'd have to tidy up. And my mom now had this enormous admiration for a black man. Mm. It was the best gift she could ever, ever have given me, more than language, more than literacy, more than all the things, mother's milk, in addition to all of that. It was seeing that's the normal world where people are people and respected as people. So very political, and I was kind of proud of them. I felt different from the other kids at school. Points of reference, friendships, different in every way. But I didn't want them to assume I'm automatically going to follow in their footsteps. And I got into poetry, and I would read poetry, and poetry was dreams and imagination and another world out there, a world of aiming for perfection and of intense beauty and rhythms and all sorts of stuff like that. But that was very interior, very personal, very intimate, just for me. And in my second year at university, so I'm completely non-political. Mm. My mother says, you must go to a lecture being given by an Afrikaans poet called Ace Krieger.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah. And she knew I loved poetry. And I go to the lecture, and it's on a Spanish poet called Federico Lorca. I didn't even know they had poets in Spain. I knew they had bullfights. And he'd been captured by the fascists during the Spanish Civil War, and he'd been executed by a firing squad. Mm. Why? Because of his poetry, because of his theater. And Ace, the little guy, very ebullient, very strong, speaking English, a bit of Afrikaans, a bit of French, quite a lot of Spanish, non-stop for 2 hours speaking. And he quoted a poem by Pablo Neruda, poet from Chile. I didn't know they had poets in South America. I knew they had alligators while we had crocodiles. And their highest mountain wasn't as high as Kilimanjaro in Africa. That's all I knew about Latin America then. And Pablo Neruda spoke about the execution of Federico Lorca, Los Cinco de la Tarde at 5 in the afternoon, at 5 in the afternoon. It was so powerful. And what it did for me was it linked up the dreaminess, the soulfulness of inward poetry with public events. And a few weeks later, I was volunteering for the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign. 1952, wow. ANC leading this movement of sitting down on benches marked whites only, and entering railway carriages whites only, and going to beaches whites only, and being out on the streets without their passes. And I'm saying, I want to join. I'm saying, you can't. Why? Because you're white. But we're fighting racism. It's a black struggle led by black people, but we'll see if you can come in. Any event, so that was really my kind of first act. So in that sense, the dreaminess, the longings, the inwardness, the imagination, the romanticism got me into politics. And I came in with it, and it was with me all the way through. When I was locked up in solitary confinement, which was terrible, 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 some years later, totally alone, nobody to speak to, no activities, no interactions, I would sing, da-da-da-da, and I would make up songs, and I'd go through the alphabet, and always, because Charmaine, some of the favorite hits of 1963, October, 6 months later, they would come from United States, take 6 months to come down to South Africa, would be in that list. And my favorite was Always. And, you know, people today don't know Always. I can't imagine people not knowing that song by Irving Berlin to his wife, I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always. And I made it into, I'll be living here always, year after year, always, in this little cell that I know so well, I'll be living swell, always, always, I'll be staying in, always, keeping up my chin, always, and not for but an hour, not for but a week, not for 90 days, but always. 90 days was called the 90-day law. You could be locked up for 90 days.
But they locked you up for longer.
And then released me for 3 minutes and locked me up for another 78 days.
I spoke to Jamal, who is usually at the front desk of Zeitz. When I looked at the exhibition yesterday, he walked us through it. And he asked me to ask you.
Yes.
What went through your mind? Because that must be the cruelest torture. To be out and to think you're going and then to go back in.
It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't. I was very suspicious. They said, you can go. So they gave me back my shoes with laces. They gave me back my watch. I'd never had a watch. I could only tell the time by hearing the city hall clock. Mm-hmm. They gave me back my tie. And it was a winter suit. I was locked up on the 1st of October. And now it's 90 days after that, so it's almost New Year. You can go. And I was very suspicious. And I'm just about to get into the street, and it was Sergeant Flock comes up to me, smiling, put out his hand. He's shaking my hand. I'm placing you under arrest under the 90-day law. So I go back to my cell. They take away my watch. They take away my tie. I take off that suit. I put on the more comfortable khaki stuff I'd been wearing. And then I did have some hard times, out-of-body experiences. Mm-hmm. I remember one of the cleaners, he was a guy from the colored community, he's sweeping and he whispering to me, take it easy, take it slow. Mm-hmm. And he had the big shoes on, clop, 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 clop. I still remember. And I somehow managed to hang in, and suddenly I'm released, like I was arrested with no reason, released with no reason, and I ran from the center of Cape Town, through the city, down to Greenpoint, down to Beach Road, up that little bit that's normally seems so flat, but it was very steep when you haven't run that distance to Clifton, where I'd grown up in Clifton, and I just jumped into the sea. And I looked like triumphant, but something inside me was broken. You never, never, never get over solitary confinement. 30 years later, We're now going to have our first democratic elections. And I hated electioneering. I hated saying, we're the best, we're the best. I remember sharing a platform with Alan Bosak. He was amazing. He would sing and he loved it. He loved electioneering. I hated it.
Yeah, it's a performance of sorts. It's a
And he was brilliant at it. And I decided I'm going to repeat the run. That's my gesture now, my gesture of joy. And I went back to the charge office, Caledon Square. And this time the mayor kissed me on my lips. It was Patricia Salkus. TV people were following, in fact, running backwards. I passed Giovanni in Greenpoint and they gave me espresso. It's not a banned substance. I didn't know if I could make it. I've now lost my arm. I've been blown up in exile. And I made it. And Basil Mannenberg Coetzee was on 4th Beach with a saxophone playing Mannenberg as I jumped into the water. So that romanticism, that love of an imaginary world, something, it's in ourselves and larger than ourselves, and we're living in both at the same time and each influencing the other. I think it's been all the way through.
And that's the thing for me, is how art intrinsically links us as people. And sometimes we don't even define it as art, whether it's music. I mean, your whistling, that part of the exhibition, that really got me as well. Art is such an integral part of who we are as South Africans. The one security assistant also, I asked her what her favorite part was of the exhibition. And she said she loved the way that they'd linked your history, South Africa's history, and art, how they'd linked all of that through the ages. That brought it home for her. How can we make art more accessible for young people in this country?
You know, let me just speak about that whistling.
Yes, please
do. Because now in the solitary confinement, you see nobody. The only sounds you hear are horrible sounds of doors slamming, commands being issued. It's a place of horrible din. And I'm singing now to hear my own voice and to feel real and like a human being. And then I hear whistling. And drunk people scream and shout and bang. Nobody whistles. And I'm listening. Hey, there's somebody out there. I don't know who it is.
Whistling back.
Not whistling back, just whistling, like I'm singing. Yeah. And I think, oh, who is it? So then I start whistling. Nkosi Sikelel' iAfrika. I'm whistling that. No response. I think the red flag, the people's flag, I'm whistling it. No response. And then I hear da 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 being whistled. And it's, for people to know, it's the slow movement of Dvorak's New World Symphony, which when he went to the United States from Czechoslovakia, he felt nostalgic for his country. And he picked up on what was called a Negro spiritual going home. So going home when you're locked up in solitary confinement, there was somebody else out there. And I whistled and the person would whistle back. I remember once I was doing my exercises, 39, 40, 41, and the whistling starts. And I had to get up to 50. And I wanted to say to the whistler, please don't stop. Please don't stop. I can't interrupt. Yes. And I get a 50, and then I whistle back. And I only discovered some months later, after I'd been released, it was Dorothy Adams. She came from Wellington, a school teacher. She'd been in a group headed by Neville Alexander. And so it wasn't ANC, it wasn't the Communist Party, it was Neville Alexander's group, and we met through whistling. And a beautiful friendship came out of that. Years later, in England, and when I was blown up, she offered to help me. She'd read in the newspapers. I said, you can assist me. I've got an office at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London. I've got funding to prepare for a new constitution for South Africa. Dorothy, please, will you come? Mm-hmm. And then when I came back to South Africa, she didn't want to come back to this country that had been so horrid to her and oppressed mm-hmm. people from the colored community and mm-hmm. forcibly removed them and denied them dignity. I said, come, and her English husband was very keen to come. Mm-hmm. And she came, and she was my assistant at the University of Western Cape for a couple of years. And it all started with whistling in prison.
It's amazing, again, those connections. And I think that's what I love about art, about the stories, about all of these things that connect us. Because the more we start looking at art and listening to each other's stories, the more we realize that we have more in common than what divides us.
And they connect us in a lovely way. It's not transactional. Mm. It's not for advantage. It's not to be richer or more powerful or more beautiful or more anything. It's just that, like a soul, a feeling, a vibration, an energy linking up with somebody else. And everybody can do it. Everybody can sing. Everybody can imagine. Everybody can dream. Everybody can dance. Mm. So there's something immensely democratic. There's the potential. And sometimes it's also very refined and complicated and difficult, and you have to work hard. It's that range that for me has been so special about the artistic realm. And you can even, I don't know, I used to have a horrible thought sometimes of the people in the ghettos, mm-hmm. and they were musicians, and the Nazis got them to play mm-hmm. classical music before sending their families to the gas chambers. That horrible perversion of these Nazis. Mm. But somehow listening to Beethoven, I couldn't get my mind around it. I still can't. That people can be often so cultivated mm-hmm. and refined and living in that lovely realm. Of deeply humane realm, mm. and yet do cruel, mm. brutal, horrible things.
It's an interesting world that we exist in. I think that's been, for me, why I really want people to pay more attention to art and to also, for example, your relationships with so many artists throughout the eras. I mean, the pieces by Feni, Dumila, it was just amazing to see the depiction of all of these emotions in painting, in sketches, in woodwork. You've got these different moments of human emotion, and the artists are able to capture that in so... It's such a beautiful language that they use. How did your relationships with the various artists that you met on their journeys, how did that impact you as a person?
Very, very powerfully. When I lived 11 years in exile in London. It's an amazing city to live in. And there are tremendous concerts and famous people coming through, and I'd read about them and say, I must go. I hardly ever went. Mm. I didn't have the money. It takes hours to get from one spot to the other and so on. So a lot was happening around me, but I was a passive listener, observer, enjoying. I go to Mozambique. It was upfront. It was strong. Newly independent, mm. and people had painted on the walls all over the city, painting on the walls, expressive. And some of the best artists were doing murals. And we had people from all over the world coming to help newly independent Mozambique, and a particularly big group of people from Chile during the time of the Pinochet dictatorship, where Pinochet tried to destroy the intelligentsia, the anti-military people, the anti-fascist people, and they fled. And they came with their songs and with their music and with their culture, several hundred living in Mozambique. And one was a landscape artist, and she was working on a mural, and she said, Albie, come, we're starting at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. I'll pick you up a mural in front of the Ministry of Agriculture. And I'd never painted anything in my life since Standard 6 drawing class, and very nervously dipped the brush in the black and followed the lines of drawing by the great Mozambican artist Malangatana. Mm. So I can say I've worked on, together with Moira Toha was her name. But that idea of expressing a new reality, the revolution they called that, in public art was very, very strong. Mm. But it was much more than that. And the strongest works at the exhibition are from Mozambique. Malangatana and Shisano, Malangatana the painter, they were both cleaners at the press club. Very poor backgrounds, very skilled, and some progressive intellectuals there saw the immense talent that they had and created opportunities, and they developed their own styles of painting, Malangatana, and sculpture, Shisano, using local materials, in the case of Shisano, the wood. And independence meant recreating the imaginations of people in Mozambique. People in Mozambique were told, you are Portuguese. Can you imagine? Millions of black African people told, you are Portuguese. Or if you're not Portuguese, assimilated Portuguese culture, you are natives. Not people with culture and languages and poetry and dreams and visions and legends and so on. Just like natives. And they would say, at school you would learn every railway siding from Lisbon to Oporto and be told your highest mountain is, it's a mountain in Portugal, that's 1,992 meters, and they put a platform to make it 2,000 meters. Our highest mountain is, they had higher mountains in Mozambique. People didn't know the names of the mountains, the rivers. Get to know your country. And every school, every factory, every government department, the law school, would have to have art. And the art would now not be drawings of mythological figures from Portuguese culture.
They were from?
From Mozambican artists with their own imagery, their own imaginations. So art wasn't just an adornment or something nice to have. It was helping to recreate the soul, the imaginative soul of Mozambicans to feel a pride in themselves. And they didn't say to the artist, make us figures of victorious people with AK-47s and viva salutes. Leaving it to the artists, leaving it to each place to choose the artwork that they wanted. There were more people making a living in Mozambique from art, even during a time of civil war, than there were in South Africa, where there were all the galleries, but all artists had to do part-time teaching, you know, to make a living. In Mozambique, the artists now were actually making quite a good living because there was such a demand. And they didn't use the word Africanizing or indigenizing, they used the word Mozambicanizing. That brought in everybody, whatever your origins and backgrounds. Overwhelmingly, Mozambicanizing meant the African dimension had to come in and express itself, but it wasn't seen as an exclusive thing.
Yes.
They didn't use the term Eurocentric, Afrocentric, they said Mozambique-centric. And all of that had a huge impact on me when I came back to South Africa.
You actually included that in the one essay that you wrote about white is also beautiful and incorporating that into our identity, because it's amazing how we love to exclude.
I remember somebody posed the question to a Mozambican leader. He'd been a student, he'd given up his studies to join the armed struggle. Comrade Sergio, what does Frelimo say about the slogan, black is beautiful? And he said, black is beautiful, brown is beautiful, white is beautiful. White has made itself ugly by making itself exclusive, and white has to learn to recover its beauty. I thought that phrase was beautiful. It gave me immense courage back in South Africa to start envisaging cultural development in our country. As something, Malangatana, I went to his house studio once, and I was surprised. It was Mozart. He was listening to Mozart. He loved Mozart. Then the tape was over, and then it was Abdullah Ibrahim, jazz, and that was over. And then he'd start singing in Ronga, which is like Shangaan, Tonga. And for him, he loved it all. He felt, I'm an African person, very, very African. Grew up in a village, I dance, I sing, I move, I speak Portuguese, I speak English, I've learned some German, I have a right to embrace the culture of the world. And it's not a competition. If I listen to Mozart, I'm not selling my soul. I'm enjoying something that's been produced externally. I adore jazz, especially jazz from South Africa, particularly like. And I've got my own cultural groups. All goes together. So I saw that. I brought that with me. When I was on the court, I helped to establish a choir. It was the security people, the admin people, and they loved it. And they even created a song about a Bill of Rights, like dancing and singing and so on. It was just natural for every unit of human activity to have its own cultural group. And then when it came to tasks that Arthur Chaskelson dished out to new Chief Justice, Ismail Mohammed, will you do rules of court? Laurie Ackerman, can you create a library for us? Tolly Madala, gowns, because he lived in Mtata near Grahamstown where gowns are being made. Kate O'Regan, what's this thing, personal computers? Can you tell us what it is? And Albie and Farah and Yvonne, that's Albie Saxon, Yvonne Mohoro, would you do decor for our temporary accommodation? And here's 10,000 rand.
Wow. As you're mentioning all of these names, I studied law at Stellenbosch University, and it's like my whole syllabus is actually you've mentioned all of their names. So I feel it is quite surreal, I must say, that I'll be sitting here next to you, going from law to art, but how it's all part of each other.
Yeah.
You brought art into the Constitutional Court, the beautiful, colorful letters on the front of it, and then, of course, the amazing pieces that, with that 10,000 rand, like Jesus, you made 10,000 rand into a lot more than that, because a lot of artists also donated pieces. I mean, I love the piece of Norman Catherine, the speaker, all the way through to, I think, young Nelson Makamo then at that point in time. How did you go about curating that?
We bought one painting with the 10,000 rand, made it into a tapestry, and it showed like humanity, that spirit of Ubuntu. Budget gone. So we had to beg, borrow, steal. The arts community were thrilled that the court, new institution, it's going to be a new building, is interested in art. And they donated. Galleries helped us. We couldn't go to private sources to get funds because they might become litigants one day. So we had to get what we could get. I opened lots of exhibitions. I'd say to Andrew Fister, you know, somebody else donated us something. And then some of the artists I knew personally. And then some we commissioned when we managed to get some funds externally, internationally.
I love the commission where you did with the Scotness in the middle, and then you incorporated. Tell me a bit about that, because that's quite a special piece. I think it's as you enter the exhibition at Zeitz.
That was our very first commission. I bumped into Cecil Scotness at the bank.
Yes.
I won't say which bank it was, because we're not advertising. And I said, Cecil, could you donate something to the court? Because I'd seen his work at the Grahamstown Arts Festival at the building there. And he said, yes, there's something at his home I might like. And it was a piece he'd done, his celebration of democracy. And it showed a figure with kind of arms a bit uplifted in his particular style. And Cecil, in the apartheid days, had thrown his studio open to artists from everywhere. And many black artists, the only opportunity to learn the craft and to be able to try out and experiment with it was in his studio. So he was heart and soul in sympathy with the change coming in South Africa. But I said, Cecil, you know, our first piece, can you collaborate with a black artist? So it's not a white man donating something. And he said, yes, he knew Hamilton Badaza, was working in the library at UWC. He could teach him how to gouge the wood and paint the wood. So now it's a combination. Yes. And in Mozambique, artists work together on murals together. I was used to that. And I know Arthur Chaskelson was worried, doesn't look like a picture you get in a court building. It's not the blindfolded woman with the scales of justice. It's not the Magna Carta.
Yes.
It's not the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's a very African depiction of human beings. He went to an artist friend. The artist gave the thumbs up salute. And that opened the way to Yvonne and myself now developing all the art that we got as diverse as possible.
I also like the piece, the drawers, and then the bull's horns, and speaking about how we like to classify art into the five or six different... Which piece would you say is worth talking about in what you have in the museum?
When you come into the gallery, almost the first thing you see, there's a figure carved out of one piece of wood.
Yes.
It's about 10 heads.
Yes, yes, that one, yes.
Now, that's a sculpture by the Mozambican artist Alberto Chissano.
Is that the one that is opposite the lady with no head?
Yes.
That's and that also, I asked another security guard which her favorite piece was, and she said that because she said there's so much, but the fact that it was carved out of wood, she was absolutely dumbfounded by it.
So that would have been an African tree.
Yes.
And he actually, Chissano, delivered the piece the day after Ruth First was killed by a letter bomb at the Eduardo Milan University. And for me, it's associated, you know, with the death of Ruth. And he said the most beautiful things about your sister Ruth and expressed condolences to the South African people having lost one of their beautiful daughters. And then he explained the work to me and he said, you see all these heads, the two heads that are very large and very comfortable. And then the eight heads of people huddled together, and the world is like that. The world is divided. And the people with the big, comfortable heads are saying, is anything the matter? They don't even understand. But there's one point of connection at the bottom. You can see their hands are touching each other. So it's a beautiful, puzzling, entrancing, baffling work in itself. And yet it's also associated with a very, very hard moment. It's got another interesting story attached to it. I went to his home studio, saw it while it was being made. I said, now he's Alberto and I'm Albert. So
Alberto,
I'm Albert. I'm speaking Portuguese. And I say, I don't have much money. I'm a professor of law. I can save up a little bit. I'd love to get it. He gave me a price. I said, I'll save it. Indira Gandhi, Prime Minister of India, visited Mozambique. Very important state visit.
Yes.
She's taken to Malangatana's home, to the sculptor's home. They're like football stars. She says, oh, what a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful piece. Expecting they're going to wrap it up. And the Mozambican security people say, can we take it? How much do you want? He said, no, I've already promised it to Professor Albie Sachs. And the Mozambican artists were thrilled. They didn't like it when government just assumed.
Everything is for their taking.
Whatever, yeah, whatever. So it's got that multiple kind of history. People say every picture tells 1,000 stories. I can tell 1,000 stories about every picture.
That is true. Can you tell me the story about the lady with no head?
It's a sad story. I think it's actually a very sexist story.
I must say, when I looked at it, I mean, I've dealt with sexism so much. I did kind of not do it to myself, but I entered a pageant and proclaimed world peace in a session, a tiara and a bikini. So
it was like saying this woman is just
that's
so
all
damn
she's,
stupid. She
yes.
hasn't got a brain in
yes.
her head.
Yes.
And there's like it's just like a skin. And he
yes.
painted that saying.
Yes.
He painted that saying. It's very striking.
It is. And I stood in front of it because I was trying to understand. And I think that's the great thing for me about art as well, is you read your own story into it. So
right.
there's 1,000 stories behind it, but each person brings their story to it as well.
And ambiguity is part of the whole thing.
Absolutely.
And contradiction.
I think that's what I love as well, is the contradiction of art, because people think of the art world as this absolutely exclusive world, and yet most of the artists are actually wanting their work to be seen by everyday people. And I love then asking the security about their favorite pieces. I love seeing art through the eyes of others and then adding their stories into it as well. The whistling, again, to me, even the photograph of you and Dumila Feni, the beautiful, beautiful paintings or sketches on both sides, that to me also spoke about how artists are so used to working with limited resources. And I realized there again how limitations in resources also teaches us so much creativity. Why do you think Africa and South Africa is a creative place?
I think the creativity hasn't been destroyed by commercialization. People sing spontaneously at weddings, at funerals, in the church, in the streets, in the communities. There's an energy, they move, they dance. When people go on strike, they're singing. And you don't have to look beautiful or be beautiful. I think it was, what's her name? I forget that story. No, the Afrikaans writer, woman.
Anki Kroch poet.
Anki said, why is there always a very large, fat woman leading the dancing when there's a strike on? And it's that sense of the inherent capacity of communication and expression through music, through song, through dance, hasn't been destroyed. It's been incorporated into our world of struggle and the anger, the denunciations, and so on. And often there's a lot of humor in it. And it means working with others and being connected with others and doing things together. So it's not all self-referential. It's not all me, 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 me. And it's not dependent on having very refined taste that's cultivated. I love very refined things and cultivated things, but I love the democratic, participatory,
and
evolving thing.
Yes.
It's raw and it's often very beautiful.
Absolutely.
Very beautiful. One soprano starts singing, a bass voice comes in, it's a new song. I never found that in England. I never found that. I think Wales had something of a tradition of popular culture amongst the mine working families. But in London, that marvelous, wonderful London, it'll be performance. You pay, you sit, you applaud, or you become a professional and you perform. We have that. We have great singers, great musicians of different kinds, wonderful jazz music, but we also have that capacity for ordinary people to participate, to articulate, and not to be paid for it, and not doing it as performance, but doing it as expression.
Albie, thank you so much for expressing yourself. To speak to me, to speak to our audience, I think that's been one of my big passions, is making sure that more people go and see exhibitions and understand how much art plays a role in who we are as a nation. So thank you so much for your time. I sincerely appreciate.
And thank you, Joanne, because you're also, one of my law clerks said when we retired from the court, our term came to an end, Albie doesn't think out of the box. He is out of the box. And you, if you don't mind my saying, say you're also out of the box.
I appreciate. I hate being in a box.
You sprang out of the box. You sprang out of the box and you've done things that you should have known your place and stuck into the predictable world, and instead you destroyed the predictions and you're creating this super, 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 super program.
I appreciate that.